You're listening to my radio at stampalky.com. Hello, I'm so pleased you've joined me again for my third podcast. This is Stan Pelkey, your host at my radio. Today I'll be reading the first half of chapter 2 of my original science fiction novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. I hope you are enjoying the story as well as my original music. I am definitely having fun producing these podcasts. You may also notice some variation in the sound quality of portions of my programs. Some of those variations are due to the fact that I'm continuing to explore how best to create each facet of these podcasts. I definitely appreciate your patience and understanding. As always, please check back regularly for new content as well as additional podcasts. Chapter 2. The Storming of Sainte-Sophie sur Douve. He woke with a start, shallow, quick breathing, his heart racing so furiously that his chest hurt and his temples throbbed with a sharp pain. In the darkness, disoriented, he reached for something, anything familiar, and felt her warm arm. It was soft and reassuring, and at his touch she stirred and sighed, sounds he knew and loved as her warm body moved closer to his, and the bed shifted and the floor creaked. How many times had it been that he'd dreamt that same horrible nightmare? As his eyes focused more thoroughly and he gradually became more alert, what had seemed to be dark of night resolved into gray of early dawn. Corporal Charlie Spear began to recognize his surroundings. He was not at home. He had not been at home for over a year now, not since he had begun his basic training as a paratrooper at Camp Tocoa in the summer of 1942. He was on a train bound for Sturgis, Kentucky, for military exercises and more tactical training. The arm beside him did not belong to Gloria Jane. It was Sherman's arm. The rest of Sherman remained indifferently slumped on the upholstered bench beside him, his right shoulder edging out into the aisle, lanky legs crossed at the ankles and knees crowding Charlie's space. A snore escaped from Sherman's mouth, and for a moment his eyes opened wide. He mumbled something indistinct, then turned and fell back asleep. It was May 1943. Charlie Spear would not sleep again, no matter how tired his body, or how sore and droopy his eyes, or how achy and creepy his legs felt. His ghost had haunted him again that night, and the image of his spectral nemesis would keep playing out in his mind's eye. There would be no escape from his distressed thoughts for hours now. They would rattle around in his head for the rest of the day and probably into the night. If this ended up being a particularly bad episode, Charlie might not sleep soundly again for 2 or 3 days. How many times now had he knowingly woken from that dream? If he spent a moment, if he really tried, he would be able to remember precisely. The first time was almost a year ago, in the early hours of May 14th, 1942. Charlie was in the middle of his 5th month as a night security guard at the Alcoa plant in Messina, New York. Fear of German saboteurs in the days immediately after Germany's declaration of war against the United States on December 11, 1941, had led to increased security on the railway lines into and out from the factory, and Charlie had been one of the lucky county men who had been hired on as night shift security guards at the beginning of January 1942. May 13, 1942, had been unseasonably cool. The evening had actually grown quite cold, and Charlie had spent a few too many minutes smoking a cigarette or two with 3 of the other new young guards before heading out along the tracks. His route took him across a long but narrow bridge, which stretched out across a wide cutting in a hill through which one of the major county roads passed. Crossing the narrow bridge on foot was normally safe enough, but that night, an unexpected freight train had come barreling up the line. Charlie was halfway across the bridge when the train's headlights emerged ahead of him out of the darkness. There was not enough room on the bridge for man and smoke-belching beast, and Charlie had begun to sprint back in the direction he'd come, a good fifth of a mile. All the way, his lungs aching, his legs burning, his heart throbbing, he'd thought of Gloria Jane, of the life he wanted to live with her, of the two little boys and two little girls he had told her that he wanted to have with her, all while they courted, and the risk now to all his hopes being crushed on that damned bridge. There was just no way he would make it, no way he could stay ahead of the monstrous machine barreling toward him from behind. He would die here, out of time and out of luck, a sad, sad collateral victim of a war being fought thousands of miles away. The bridge shook wildly beneath him as the train's horrific wheels ground along only dozens of feet behind him. There were no grains of sand left to fall in the hourglass of his destiny. Yet at the last possible moment, with the end of the bridge just a few feet ahead, safety ever so near, Charlie Spear had felt a sudden burst of energy roar through him. As if swept off his feet, he'd taken a leap of desperate faith and had landed bruised but ultimately safe in a ditch beside the train tracks just beyond the end of the bridge. Terrifying steam whistles tore the night apart as he lay there, gasping with relief and shock, while the massive freight train roared past and the ground trembled beneath him. He'd been inches away from death, inches away from... Ghost? I am meeting myself, he muttered into the gloomy morning. He glanced around the coach car to make certain he had not woken any of his fellow soldiers. I cheated death, and now I'm meeting myself in some could-have-been realm. Despite the terror that the dream inspired, Charlie whispered a silent prayer, "Thank God, thank God, thank God." Sherman stirred again beside him, and Charlie Spear fell silent. That had been the first night he dreamt the nightmare. In the early hours of May 14th, 1942, exhausted from his ordeal on the bridge, Charlie had fallen asleep in his own bed at nearly dawn. Gloria Jane's soft, warm body curled up close to his, her breath tickling the hairs on his neck. He'd finally felt at peace. And then the dream, and the sudden waking, and the pounding heart. His mind had been overwhelmed by the otherworldly terror, and he'd lain in bed in a stupor, unable to respond to Gloria Jane as she half woke and urged him to hold her. Charlie had not had to work at the Alcoa plant the next evening, and he had tried to relieve his mind by working most of the chilly spring day in their small garden, drenched by bright sunlight. But the dream haunted him, despite the sunlight and fresh air. That evening over dinner, Charlie mustered the will to tell Gloria Jane about the close encounter with the train, but he did not mention the nightmarish haunting. "I cannot believe they didn't tell you about that train," she snapped. "I shouldn't have had that second smoke. It was partly my fault. You should quit that job. There'll be something else for you." "I can't quit. There's nothing else. Billy Clayton found work in town. So did Frank Stone. Even Sherman got a job on that big company farm. I tried, sweetheart. I really did. I went into every shop and store from Orvis Street to Hatfield. There was nothing left. Just the new jobs at the factory. We could ask my father. He wanted us to come back to Albany." "That's admitting defeat," Charlie replied. "I've already lost the farm. It took so much already to move here, to get the one job I could get." Charlie looked down at his hands on the kitchen table. Just a few short years earlier, he'd thought those hands would be solving mathematical equations or drafting engineering plans by now, but all that had changed. "But he told you that you could work at the store," Gloria Jane continued. "But I had bigger plans," Charlie replied. "We both did," she said. He glanced up at her. She was everything to him now, and he knew that Gloria Jane had also given up so much. His heart broke that much more. "I know. None of this is fair, to either of us, especially to you. But I just can't fall back on your father's generosity. I finally have to be my own man." Gloria Jane fell silent, her face taking on the stone-like expression of smoldering anger at the injustice of the world. It was a look Charlie had come to know all too well, even after only 8 months of marriage. Charlie pushed back his chair, stood, and came around to Gloria Jane. He touched her warm, soft arm as he knelt on the floor beside her. Then he leaned over and kissed her cheek. Boy, he loved her. He'd do just about anything for her, but they'd have been worse off without that job. "I'll be more careful, I promise." Gloria Jane did not reply, but she pulled her arm away and turned her face toward the kitchen window so that her eyes would not meet Charlie's. They did the dishes in silence. Then Charlie went out and sat on the back steps to smoke a cigarette while Gloria Jane listened to a radio program, favorite dance tunes, and some patriotic songs. The sky grew darker and the evening crickets began their merry chirping. Frogs answered with croaking responses. Off to the west, a dog barked, then another further off. A baby cried in the house next door. The stars came out, one, two, several more. Soon, the entire panoply had emerged. At first, Charlie did not notice that the dance music from the radio had grown a little bit louder, but he turned at the sound of the kitchen door swinging open on its squeaky hinges, and he saw Gloria Jane, backlit by the kitchen light. She came out and sat down beside him. He offered her what was left of his cigarette, but she just shook her head. "The world is a crazy mess," she said softly. "Strong-backed men willing to do work, but nothing for them to do. Madmen sending the world to war. Families losing their farms all over the country. It's just not right." "It's not just men without work," Charlie replied. Gloria Jane made the softest of defiant sounds. "Well, I've given up on my dream." "You shouldn't. Maybe the world will change," Charlie said. "Maybe the war will make people think differently about lots of stuff." He leaned back to look up at the stars. "Under those lights, you can believe just about anything's possible," he whispered. She leaned back too and looked up at the bright stars. "Like women engineers?" she asked, laughing. "Yes, like women engineers." Charlie took her hand in his and squeezed it gently. "I believe in you." He leaned close again and kissed her neck and ear. She turned her head so that their lips met. "Dance with me," she said softly. "Out here?" "Yes, out here, under the stars." They rose and held each other close, swaying to the sound of the music playing on the radio. There was nowhere he'd rather be than right there with her. "I'll look for a new job again tomorrow," he whispered. She smiled lightly and led him back into the kitchen. Charlie's lips twitched into the slightest of smiles as he recalled that night. The door shut, they'd fallen into each other's arms, eagerly expressing their love with more kissing, gentle words, and bodies. He had never felt closer to Gloria Jane as they lay together talking long into the night after they had finished their lovemaking. In those hours of joy and passion and tenderness, Charlie had forgotten everything, every fear, every sorrow. They had talked again about their hopes for the future. They'd work hard, save, and both go back to school. They'd have children after that, hire a young cousin to help care for the house and children so that they could start a building firm together. When those topics had entertained them long enough, Gloria Jane told him about some of the mathematical puzzles she had been trying to solve that week. "I wonder what these guys would think if they knew my wife and I talked about math in bed," Charlie chuckled softly. He certainly knew Sherman thought there were better things for women to be talking about than figures and sums. But Gloria Jane was unlike any young woman he'd ever met before, and Charlie was still in awe of the fact that she'd chosen to spend her life with him. Eventually, Gloria Jane had fallen asleep, but Charlie could not sleep, nor would he for three more nights. Each time he closed his eyes, the spectral decaying head bobbed into his mind's eye, grinning and illuminated by a cold blue light. All the warmth of the evening drained away, and he was left cold and naked before a hostile universe. Charlie had stuck with a security job at Alcoa for several more weeks, but the wear and tear on his body from too little sleep was real. Even he recognized that exhausted, he put himself at greater risk, especially on those nights he had to follow the tracks across the cutting in the hillside. One afternoon in early June, Sherman had appeared at the back door. He and Charlie had barely seen each other for the past few months, not since Charlie, Gloria Jane, Sherman, and several of their other friends had finally quit Malone to try to find work in the much larger Messina. The Depression was destroying the small farming communities of the North Country, and they had decided together to get out before it was too late. "Here's the plan, Charlesy," Sherman said, tossing a rolled-up newspaper at his friend's feet. "What's this?" "Paratroopers." "Enlist?" Charlie scanned the article Sherman had circled. "Paratroopers? Jump out of planes?" "Extra pay. They're going to call us up eventually anyway. Might's well get the most we can." "Absolutely not," Gloria Jane threw the newspaper back down onto the kitchen table that evening. "That's even worse than staying on at the factory." "I can't pay our bills," Charlie said simply. "I'm failing us both." "You'll enlist, but you won't work for my father?" Charlie did not reply. "This is other people's war," Gloria Jane continued. "It will be over soon." "No, it won't. The news gets worse each week, and Sherm's right. We'll eventually be drafted anyway." "But I don't want you to go," she whispered. "Something terrible will happen. I just know it will. It'll be okay. We'll all survive this. We've survived this long." Charlie had made his decision, and blessedly, the dream ceased for a time, and the haunted feeling diminished. But as spring turned to summer, and his enlistment date approached, the dream returned. If Charlie concentrated, he would be able to remember how many times now. It had been 11 times, and each subsequent iteration was no less disturbing than the first. In his heart of hearts, Corporal Charlie Spirit knew that he was meeting his own dead self. For a moment, the hair on the back of his neck stood on end, and an involuntary shiver ran across his spine, right down to the dull soreness in his hip that had not been completely right since he'd fallen on the icy road near his grandfather's house in 1939. Charlie knew that experience had been real. But the dream within the dream, layers of hauntings within a haunted nightmare, it was such a complex delusion. He'd never known a Charlotte Benoit, yet there had been times in the past year when she seemed more real to him than Sherman or Billy did. And while Charlie had retrieved Sherman drunk and itching for a fight dozens of times at the Flanagan's Tavern, that strange haunted night at the hotel had never happened. The only disturbed night spent with Sherman was the awkward one when he'd had to undress his best friend before putting him to bed after Sherman had thrown up all over himself in the street. They'd stumbled back up the county road to his grandfather's farm, Sherman struggling to walk after drinking so much, his breath and clothes reeking of alcohol and vomit. Grandpa Spear had met them at the door, disgusted by the sight and smell of Sherman, but more so by the boy's destructive behavior. "Strip him off in the back," Grandpa had said, scowling. That was the first time Charlie had seen dozens of bruises all across Sherm's back and legs. Those weren't from a tavern fight or a near escape from a haunted train station. They were the work of Sherman's own absolutely horrible father. Even Grandpa's tone changed when he saw the bruises. "Poor lad," he whispered as he helped Charlie lift the unconscious Sherman into the bed in the back guest bedroom on the first floor. Even the old train station was a figment of Charlie's mind. There was only one train station in their hometown, not two, and it looked nothing like the place he kept dreaming about. Charlie could not remember ever being in such a place. Maybe it was one of the stations he'd passed through on rides to Albany or Buffalo when he'd gone visiting his parents' families. He wished he could ask his Grandpa Spear, now that he needed to know, but the dear old man was dead, like Charlie's parents before him. That much of the nightmare and Charlie's living reality were congruent. Sherman snored himself awake again, and this time his eyes fixed on Charlie's face. "We there yet? Don't know. Don't think so. You wake long? A while. Can't sleep." Sherman smacked his lips several times and felt around for his canteen. After drinking several sips of water, he screwed the top back on and stuffed it back into his rucksack. His long legs were now twisted up underneath the bench, and for the first time in hours, Charlie was able to stretch out his legs. That provided some relief to his stiff legs and sore hip, but his mind was still restless and his pulse remained elevated. Sherman Livernois and Charlie Spear had been an odd pair since childhood, the former tall and incredibly thin, the latter shorter and heavier set. Sherman had roamed the dusty streets and backwoods of Malone. Charlie had been a dutiful farm boy whose family had owned and worked some of the best acreage in the county. Sherman had lived in a crumbling house on the western edge of the village with his father, a bitter drunk who'd once been a reasonably successful carpenter until his wife had left Malone after having an affair. Sherman had been 10 at the time, and his life was never the same after his mother disappeared. With his father growing increasingly indifferent toward him, Sherman became increasingly indifferent to school, church, the sheriff. He barely finished 7th grade. Charlie had worked hard in school all while growing up and had completed one semester of college before returning home to help Grandpa Spear, who was growing increasingly ill, on the farm. Sherman loved to play cards and gamble, and he had a sweet spot in his heart for pretty, youth-filled blondes, something that had been getting him into trouble with other young men since their early teens. Charlie had grown up in an old country Baptist church. Fiddle music and a taste of home-brewed alcohol behind the barn were one thing, but never card playing, and certainly never on Sundays. That much he remembered of his father's exhortations before the terrible automobile accident claimed his parents' lives. The fact was that Charlie and Sherman had become like brothers when they were 8 or 9, and nothing was going to change that for Charlie. No matter how badly life treated Sherman or how foolishly Sherman reacted to life, Charlie had been Sherman's most vocal defender for almost a decade. He'd watched out for him, and he did all he could to clean up Sherman's messes. Sherman had more than once reciprocated by defending the bookish Charlie with fists and sometimes even more. Sherman had continued to drift along during their late teens, and he might have drifted completely away if not for having been so tightly anchored to Charlie for most of his life. But after that horrible night when Charlie and his grandpa saw the bruises, Sherman never went back home. He began to live with Grandpa and to help on the farm, especially when Charlie headed to college. Under Grandpa's care, Sherman had actually sobered up. Then Charlie had come home, taken over the farm, and married Gloria Jane. He was going to make something of himself, and in the process he was going to help Sherman to do the same. But as the Depression worsened and the farm remained unprofitable, Charlie was forced to sell off more and more of the family farm. After Grandpa Spear died, Charlie decided to leave Malone for Messina with the hope of finding steady work as America's war efforts geared up. Charlie had not been particularly popular as a teen, nor a natural leader, but now a small group of friends decided to leave with him, and they looked to him for guidance. In the end, enlisting in the paratroopers with Sherman had made so much sense, and not just for the better pay. Charlie could not risk having Sherman spiral back down into despair and the alcohol abuse that had almost claimed his life several times in the past few years. And so they headed off together to survive basic training at Camp Croft in North Carolina. They continued to provide moral support to each other as they trained as paratroopers at Camp Tocoa. They had survived the extensive physical training and development of military discipline, the long runs, the endless awful camp food, the good officers and the bad. Along the way, the two New York country boys welcomed other farmers turned warriors from across the country into a tight-knit circle. Together, they were preparing to invade Nazi-occupied Europe. This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.